And Barbara Ehrenreich is here, author of more than 20 books. Some of you know her best for Nickel and Dimed. Her most recent, now out in paperback, is kind of a counterintuitive take on positive thinking and how it is used and abused in both politics and personal life. It's called Brightsided: How Positive Thinking is Undermining America. Hi, Barbara. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Nice to be with you, Brian.
First, what do you mean by positive thinking? Optimism or self-boosterism, or where would you start?
Well, there's an ideology in this country which says that, you know, you should be positive, you should be optimistic, you should at least appear so at all times, because if you are, good things will actually happen to you. And if you aren't, you know, if you think, like, if you're doubtful or pessimistic, then bad things will happen to you. It's a kind of magical thinking, and it's very widespread.
It's magical thinking, you say, but it's appears to be rooted in at least what people claim to be a science. There is a science of positive psychology, which you critique in the book. Is this an official branch of psychology, like cognitive or Freudian?
Well, they would like to think so. But I think even practitioners and those who assume the label of positive psychology would be quick to tell you that it's often not as well based on evidence as it could be. There's a certain amount of wishful thinking in positive thinking, positive psychology. You know, they're the source of the assertions you'll often find in the media saying optimistic people live longer or survive cancer better or something. Most of those studies, as I argue in my book, turn out to be pretty shaky. I mean, maybe in some studies, actually, cantankerous people live longer. Now, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't believe much of any of this. But I think it's not something I would call an actual scientific discipline.
Does your critique go back to the classic book, The Power of Positive Thinking, by Norman Vincent Peale, that I think put the phrase so into the mainstream in the 1950s?
Oh, yeah. In the 1950s, Norman Vincent Peale was a pastor, a Protestant pastor in New York City, and he discovered he could make a lot of money and be very famous by speaking especially to salespeople, salesmen, as they were in the 50s usually, and bucking them up, you know, pumping them up to go out there and sell. And it was all this idea, if you think it's going to happen, it will. You just have to visualize success, keep reminding yourself of what a terrific person you are, how much you deserve, all that money you want, and so on, and it'll happen.
And you think it doesn't matter. If you go out there and you try to sell, let's say you do work in sales, and you go out there and you kind of don't feel very good about yourself, you're going to communicate that, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, I can kind of almost understand it for salespeople because they suffer so much rejection. And you have to pick yourself up after being rejected and kind of soldier on to the next person you're going to try to sell to. And so this was good. You know, he's Norman Vincent Peale, and now much more recently, of course, many, many motivational speakers will get audiences on their feet, pumping their fists.
You even put Oprah in this category.
Oh, yes. Well, Oprah has been a big promoter of the idea that you can control everything with your mind, you know, that and if whatever you visualize will happen. She was a big promoter of the book The Secret in 2006, which was all about how you can have whatever you want, a lot of money, a boyfriend, whatever it is, just by attracting that to yourself with your thoughts.
And if you're just joining us, Barbara Ehrenreich is my guest. Her book, Brightsided: How Positive Thinking is Undermining America, now out in paperback. So to the subtitle, what does this kind of thing undermine? How is it not just harmlessly wrong if it is wrong? How does it undermine something?
What it undermines is our ability to look out for possible dangers. And I show in the book about how this positive thinking was one factor leading up to the financial crash of 2008. Because, you know, financial companies and mortgage companies all had bought into this ideology. You've got to be positive at all times, to the point where if you were the kind of, you know, so-called negative person who might want to say to your boss, I'm a little worried about all that subprime mortgage exposure our company has, you could be fired for that. I wasn't good. Why be a bummer? Why raise things like that when everybody's trying to get, you know, in together on the program, with the program of how nothing bad could happen?
So there was an institutional optimistic bias. And on the political level, you see positive thinking as a tool of political repression, both in the United States and around the world. You cite, for example, the old Soviet Union, which is not what we would think of as a cheerful sort of arrangement, as you put it, but that there was actually a Stalinist demand for optimism. What was Stalinist optimism?
Well, you had to believe that everything was going to turn out well, you know, that production quotas would always go up and that everybody was happy with this form of communism. And if you didn't, you were a, quote, defeatist. And that could mean, you know, losing your job, could mean being sentenced to a labor camp.
And this became an imperative in the arts, for example, which, you know, makes for, in its own way, a dreary art scene if everything had to be upbeat.
Oh, yes. And the same I have read is true of contemporary North Korean literature. You know, it can't be morbid. It can't be introspective. It has to always be upbeat.
And do you think this imperative for optimism and positive thinking in the United States has political implications?
Well, I think on one simple level, we're not likely to elect people to office who are pessimists anymore, or frankly pessimistic.
Do you want
to say we face a lot of problems?
Do you want to elect people who are pessimists?
I sure do.
Really?
Well, I want to. Well, not in the sense that they don't think anything can be fixed, but that they acknowledge serious problems, and that we're not going to just use cheerleading to get us through them.
So,
as in a sense, you know, George W. Bush was a cheerleader going back to his college days, and I think that's almost how he understood the presidency. Keep boosting people's spirits no matter what was happening.
So what about the optimism in the Obama campaign? Yes, we can. And Obama hope while pointing out problems. Are those necessary to organize people for change?
I don't know. First I would point out about yes, we can. That's we, not I. The positive thinking mantra would be, yes, I can. I can do anything individually, all by myself, with the power of my mind. Yes, we can is a union slogan, which meant collectively, by putting our, you know, our strength and our intelligence together, we can get somewhere. So I kind of, you know, he wasn't as bad as he might have been in that respect.
Where would you put leaders like Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Thich Nhat Hanh, if you're familiar with him in Vietnam, on the positive thinking scale, or would you?
Well, Martin Luther King definitely said we were going to have to struggle to get what we wanted. He was not saying, nor was Gandhi, so far as I know, saying you just have to visualize, say, independence from the British Empire, or we just have to visualize an end of segregation in the American case. No, they were saying we have to struggle. I won't attempt to pronounce the last guy's name, but I think he would fall a little more into the positive thinking category of mind over matter. If you think it'll be true.
I do notice that you bring this into the public health realm as well, the pink ribbon fight against breast cancer in this context as somehow undermining feminism. You even see the response to swine flu as positive thinking undermining public health. Can you give us just a short thought on that? Either one of those?
Yeah, let me take the breast cancer case, because I did have breast cancer. I was diagnosed with it about 9 years ago, and I was stunned that by the constant exhortations to be positive. If I wanted to get better, I had to think positively. If I had any doubts or negative feelings or fear or anger, which I had a lot of, I would condemn myself. That was really the line. And all the pink ribbons and the races and everything was about keeping upbeat. Now, I want to point out, that Brian, that we have plenty of evidence now that whether you recover or not from cancer has nothing to do with your outlook. I mean, we have plenty of studies now on that. But I found it really oppressive when I was going through this, because in a way I was being told if I didn't get better, it was my own fault. You know, it wasn't the Medicaid, it wasn't the medicines, it wasn't the treatments. It was just that I had the wrong attitude.
I've heard other people complain about this, people's expectations of them while they are the patient. I did notice that your last words in the book, before you go, urge people to fight the good fight, politically for the most part. And then you say, if I may end with my own secret of happiness, we can have a good time trying. So you're a closet yellow smiley face after all.
No, I'm not against people being happy and having a good time. I am, notorious for, smiling at babies and going out, starting conversations with strangers and so on. But I think we need to just face squarely what's coming at us, whether that's global warming or the possibilities of a pandemic or levees breaking in the face of a hurricane. Got to look at the danger so you can do something about it.
Barbara Ehrenreich, Bright-Sided, How Positive Thinking is Undermining America. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.